Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
So now for the people that don't know who you are, let's talk about a little bit about you and where you came from and what brought you into writing about this mysterious death of Diana.
Yeah, well, I'm actually a New Zealander. I was born in New Zealand. I've been in Australia though for about something like 26 years, and I got interested in the case of Princess Diana's death after Paul Burrell, her butler, wrote a book in 2003 in which he published a note from Diana that predicted that she could die in a car crash, an orchestrated car crash. And so that when I saw that handwritten note, which was published in the newspapers around the world, I thought, well, that's very interesting that she predicted that. She actually wrote it in October 1995, and then within two years of that, she actually did die, and also in the same myth which she had predicted in the note. So that was a very significant little piece of evidence, I thought. And anyway, I actually remember cutting that out of one of the newspapers here, and then a few years later, or a couple of years later, I'd actually come down with a very severe illness, and I had to retire. And then 2005, I was looking at what I could do, and I decided I could write. And so I was looking at what I'd write about, and I figured out that could be worth me doing some research on that crash. So that's what I did. And then by 2006, when the police investigation was completed in December 2006, I'd already done about 18 months of research on the crash, so I was starting to get a picture of what had taken place. And then when the police did their Paget report, which they put out on the internet, I printed it off and read through it, 800 pages of the Paget report. I then realised that the police investigation had not really been an investigation into determining what happened, but instead they were more interested in preparing to cover up. There was just so many errors in that report, and I realised that when I started reading, because I already knew a fair bit about it. So I was in the process at that stage of writing a book on the death of Diana, and I actually ended up changing it to a book on the Paget report. And so I wrote a book called Cover Up of the Royal Murder, Hundreds of Errors in the Paget Report. And that book got published in the same month that the inquest started. So the police investigation was completed December 2006, and the inquest started 10 months later in October 2007. And in the intervening period, I completed the book and had it published in that month that the inquest started. And that book was distributed by Mohammed Al-Fayed to the lawyers at the inquest, and I've had feedback from lawyers saying that they used that book during the inquest. And so then when the inquest started and went on for 6 months, the transcripts were downloaded on the or uploaded onto the internet every day, and I was downloading them here and reading through the inquest as it happened. And so I was very interested in the inquest because I was thinking, well, the Paget and the police investigation had been so corrupted, and I sort of thought, well, now we've got a jury, so how is this going to work? How are they going to get this through? So I studied the transcripts, and I ended up writing a series of books. I've written 6 volumes, a series of each aspect of the case, based on what was the inquest transcripts, but also based on what's in the Paget report. And also in 2010 I received a huge batch of documents that were from within the British police investigation, and they were very critical documents to the case, and none of them were shown to the jury. And so I produced a book called Diana Inquest, the Documents the Jury Never Saw, and I published those documents. And amongst those documents are things like the post-mortem reports for Princess Diana and Dodi Fayed, which none of which were shown to the jury, even though they were investigating the cause of death. They were not shown the post-mortem reports. I produced the 6 volumes on the Diana inquest. And so basically one of the things that was interesting about the inquest was that the verdict of the jury was quite different to what the police investigation had concluded. Like, initially there was a French investigation, police investigation, that started on the day of the crash, and in 1999 they produced a result that stated the crash was caused by a driver who was drunk, being Henry Paul, the driver of the Mercedes, who was drunk. And then in the British investigation, which, like I said, finished in 2006, their conclusion was that the crash was caused by a driver who was speeding and influenced by drink. So very, very similar finding to the French police investigation. And then when the jury produced their verdict, it was quite different. Their verdict was unlawful killing by the driver of the Mercedes, but also by following vehicles, which were unidentified following vehicles, and it can be shown that they were not paparazzi who were riding scooters and driving cars, so they were not the following vehicles that the jury were talking about, and that's why they were unidentified. So their finding was unlawful killing by these following vehicles and the driver, so quite different to what the police had concluded. So, in effect, the establishment didn't really get it completely past the jury, even though the true finding would have been murder. That verdict was withheld by the coroner, so the jury could not find for murder. So they would have, if they'd thought murder, then they would have had to decide it was an open verdict. the jury was not unanimous. There was 9-2, so the two people who didn't conclude unlawful killing may have concluded murder. You just don't know.
Right. Well, so when you say cover up and stuff on the police, so do you think they intentionally covered it up, or was it just really bad police work?
Oh, no, it was intentionally covered up. I think one of the things that, if you're in the study into the way the Patchett was done, there's elements of them trying to find the truth, and I think it's the lower-level officers that were working on the case. Some of them were genuinely interviewing witnesses and genuinely trying to establish what occurred. So the Patchett Report's a very strange document because there's a mix of that. So in the Patchett Report, there's quite a bit of evidence that indicates murder. But the conclusions drawn by the Patchett Report are that it was an accident caused by the drunk driver. So it's sort of a bit of a mix, but the overall thing is that the police at the top were covering up, so they had to reach a conclusion that was not murder, and so that's what happened. But it's interesting here that Patchett Report, so it's full of this stuff that indicates murder, and they draw these conclusions of an accident. So it's quite easy to, when I did my book, to show, okay, well, this evidence is indicating murder, this is in the Patchett Report, and yet they conclude this, and it's just a complete contradiction to what the evidence was. Very, very strange report.
And so how was it for you when you were investigating and researching all the different books you've done? How was it with you? Like, how were the police toward you, and how were just general people when you were trying to investigate or research?
Oh, well, I've had people that have helped me, mainly people in the UK, and mainly people that want to remain anonymous. But like I said, those documents, I mean, that when I received that batch of documents that the jury never saw, well, that really made an impact on my investigation, and so that really helped me immensely. So I've had sort of support like that. I haven't really had any direct overtures from the establishment that against me, although there's a lot of indirect stuff on the internet, and I've had interference in various ways with my work, but nothing direct, that you could sort of say, well, this person's given me a death threat or anything like that.
So now let's start with what happened. Now, so do you think that the accident was all kind of predetermined, like they kind of planned the accident?
Yeah, it was a planned operation. But what happened is Diana was under surveillance, so they were monitoring her phone, she was travelling around off Dodie and various trips that she was making, and anyway, there was a phone call that Dodie fired her lover. He made a phone call to the Ritz in Paris, which was owned by his father, and he made that phone call on the 18th of August 1997. So that was 2 weeks before the death, and during that phone call it was clear from anyone monitoring it, and there's no doubt Dodie's phone calls would have been monitored as well as Diane. There was a very clear statement that they would be travelling to Paris at the end of August. So basically they had anyone doing the operation, which was the evidence indicates MI6, they were aware that the couple would be travelling to Paris at the end of August. So they had 2 weeks basically to organise the detail of what they were going to do. And it's an extremely well planned operation. I think it was done with the help of the French intelligence and also the CIA. So you can see the evidence of planning right through the operation, you know, like there's things like there's evidence of how they were going to even cover it up. So they already knew in advance what they were going to do to cover it up. Things like the nailing it on the paparazzi and also on the truck driver. So if you walk down the streets of London and start asking people who killed Diana, a lot of people will say the paparazzi, or even anywhere that you ask them in Australia or the US, they'll say the paparazzi. They were chasing her to her death, you know. And then the other thing they might say, well, the driver, because he was drunk. So there's just two things, and that line is in a lot of people's minds, even though they're both erroneous, but they're in people's minds as the cause of the crash. So these things were worked out before the crash even occurred, and you can see the evidence of it. Things like Henry Paul, who was working for intelligence, even though he had no idea of what he was involved in, he had no idea that they were about to kill Diana. He probably thought that the things he was doing for the intelligence would be helping to protect her. But one of the things he did was, and he was paid very well, there's a lot of money that went into his accounts that was unaccounted for. And the investigations, and one of the things he was doing was that at the hotel on the night, he was making regular trips out to the paparazzi. Now, he was the acting head of security for the hotel, so they basically don't interact with the paparazzi, these guys, because the hotel is about securing the well-being of the guests, and Diana and Dodie were VIP guests, and yet Henry Paul was going out to the paparazzi and telling them, oh, they're going to be out in about 15 minutes, they're going to be out in 10 minutes. And as it got later in the night, he went out there more. You know, he made about 5 trips in total to the paparazzi out the front of the hotel, telling them they're not going to be very long. And so why does anyone do that? I mean, you'd be doing the opposite if you were had the interests of the couple who weren't interested in being hounded by the paparazzi. So the reason that he was doing it was to make sure the paparazzi didn't go home, because they once it got to 11 o'clock or towards 12 o'clock, you know, it'd be easy for the paparazzi to think, oh, well, they're going to be staying in the hotel overnight, there's no point in waiting out here. So he was making sure they were staying, and he was being paid to do that. So then when the Mercedes did leave the hotel, the paparazzi were still there, and they followed the Mercedes. And like I said before, they were on scooters and in small cars. And once it got onto the expressway heading towards the Elven Tunnel, well, the paparazzi had no chance of keeping up, because they just didn't have the power in the vehicles they were in. And the witnesses who saw what happened on the expressway, they all say that they saw several motorbikes surrounding the Mercedes, and these are large and dark motorbikes with a couple of billion passengers on. So these motorbikes also were taking flash photos and as the car headed towards the Elmer Tunnel. So they were basically what I call fake paparazzi. They were pretending to be paparazzi. So this was the whole thing. The paparazzi were there at the hotel. They followed the Mercedes. The people saw motorbikes surrounding the Mercedes. The people who saw the motorbikes probably thought they were paparazzi as well. But the fact is, the paparazzi were accounted for on the night, and they were not riding these motorbikes. So then you've got to say, well, who was riding them, and one of the aspects of that is that none of these riders on these motorbikes have ever been identified. And even when the jury found for unlawful killing by firing vehicles, which was specifically the motorbikes, that's what they were talking about. These people on the motorbikes that the witnesses saw, several witnesses had different accounts, but they all saw a cluster of motorbikes around the Mercedes. The jury verdict was unlawful killing by those motorbikes, and yet after the inquest was completed, there was then no attempt by any of the authorities in France or the UK to establish the identity of those motorbikes. So if that had been a normal person who had died and it had been established that they had been forced into the crash through surrounding motorbikes, and there was also a stroke-like flash to the driver inside the tunnel. If that had been a normal person that was done to, then immediately concluding an inquest that decided that that these motorbikes were the cause of the crash and they were unidentified, then immediately following that, there would be a police investigation set up to establish who those motorbike riders were, and that never occurred. So it's all part of the cover-up. A lot of things are about what didn't happen, you know, and that's a thing that didn't happen. The police never lifted a finger to find out who was riding on those motorbikes.
Well, was there a detail, like, there to protect Diana? Because, like, you know, in the U.S. they have Secret Service, and even on old leaders or people that are no longer in power, they still have Secret Service following them. So does England have the same?
The royals do, but Diana wasn't a royal at the time of her death, so she had been removed from the royal family by the Queen a year earlier. And also on top of that, even when she was a royal, in 1994 she had requested that her police guard be withdrawn. So she was no longer under day-to-day bodyguard sort of protection from the police after, I think it was late 1994. So, yeah, that was one of the aspects of the case was the police said, well, if we had been protecting her, this wouldn't have happened.
You've also mentioned about they're in the crash, and I know you talked about the post-crash medical treatment of Diana. Yeah. So it wasn't very good or deliberate?
She survived the crash. So what happened is when the crash occurred, it crashed into the 13th pillar of the tunnel head-on at 60 mile an hour, and the two people that were on the driver's side, the front, the driver in the front, and then Dodie Fahed in the back, he was on the driver's side, both of them died instantly. And the two people on the passenger side, which was Trooper East Jones, who was in the front of the bodyguard, he's still alive. And Princess Diana in the back, she survived as well. So both of those people on the passenger side survived. And so when the way this occurred was the medical treatment in the ambulance was really the thing that really took her life, because what occurred was, firstly, when people rang in to the base, so immediately after the crash, 12:23 a.m., there were phone calls coming into Sarlene, which is the ambulance base headquarters in Paris, and there's two people in the base that run the base, two doctors that run the base overnight in Paris, and there was one of them was asleep, and the other one was Dr. Arno De Rossi, and he was taking the calls. And then he allocated an ambulance to that crash, which was Dr. Jean-Marc Martino, and he allocated that ambulance. And then, so what happened is Martino travelled to the crash, and he didn't arrive until 12:40, so he arrived 17 minutes after the crash. Now, the ambulance left from the Necker Hospital, which was the base hospital, and it was 2.3 kilometres from the crash scene. So that took a hell of a long time to get to the crash. In actual fact, when you go through the transcripts, you work out the time that the ambulance left, which was 12:27, so it was 4 minutes after the crash, and it took 13 minutes to travel 2.3 kilometres. So it was travelling at an average of 11.5 kilometres an hour, which in the US would be 7 miles per hour. So it was travelling very, very slowly. I think what happened is it might have been travelling fast, but it stopped at some point on the way, probably for instructions. And you've got to understand that intelligence agencies use people as agents to do their work. And they use people from all sorts of walks of life. So people can have a career as a doctor but also be working as an agent. It could be your next door neighbour, you just don't know. But there are, that's how they operate. So the people have a normal job and then they'll be also working for intelligence as a part-time, and they'll get a lot of money for what they do. So as it turns out, what happened is that ambulance arrived at the crash scene, and immediately it arrived, Martino called the base and he spoke to De Rossi and said, "We're here," and the transcript of the call was shown at the inquest, and he said that about the number of people in the car and that sort of thing. And then immediately after that call, De Rossi left the base and headed straight to the crash scene. He left so quickly he didn't even wake up the other doctor, so it was left to an auxiliary to wake up the other doctor, which was Dr. Mark Lejeune. Now, when you piece all the evidence together, what happens is that De Rossi, who was manning the phones at the base, and Martino were both working for intelligence. So when De Rossi got to the crash scene, he then had two doctors there working for intelligence. And what occurred was that it took them 1 hour 43 minutes to deliver Diana to the hospital. So there was a very long period of time when she was in near care. And people sort of, like at the inquest, one of the issues was that, well, the system in Paris is different. And it is different, it's true. Like in the US, what happens is they call it scoop and run. And so when a person is in a car crash and injured, the ambulance will rush to the scene and pick up the victim and rush them to the hospital. And then in Paris and in France, what they have is a system called stay and play. And they have ambulances that have a doctor on board, which generally in the US, and certainly here in Australia, they don't have a doctor on board the ambulance. But in Paris they do. And they have more equipment on the ambulance. So what they call stay and play. So what they do is they ambulance arrives at the crash scene and then tries to stabilise the patient and then takes them to hospital, and they will do more at the scene than what they would in the other sort of Western countries. But the thing is that even in France, there are times when they will still rush a person to hospital, and it depends on what the injuries are, what the perception of the injuries are. So if you've got a patient who is in Diana's situation, and Diana's situation was very interesting because when they first tested it on what they call the Glasgow Coma Scale, she registered 14 out of 15. This was done in the car while she was still in the car. She registered 14 out of 15, and that's basically an assessment of her condition in her head. And that's something that's used around the world. It's the Glasgow Coma. And so that meant that she was in, considering what she'd been through, she had been in a 60-mile-an-hour car crash and wasn't wearing a seatbelt. So her body was swung around 180 degrees and she was left with her on the floor of the back. So her back was against the back of the front seat, and her legs were up on the back seat. So she'd been through a very severe crash, and yet she came out 14 out of 15. So she did, she came out extremely well. But the thing is that doctors knew that if you're in a high speed crash like that, there could be some sort of internal injury. And then when they eventually, and everything took a long time with this, they took 20 minutes from when the ambulance arrived to get her, to get her out of the car, and then she got into the ambulance at 106. So 106 is already sort of 43 minutes after the crash. Anyway, once in the ambulance, they've got the records there, they externally assess her, examine her, and they, in the records there it says they saw a thoracic trauma. So they saw bruising from in the chest, and that's shown that there'd been a thoracic trauma. Now, once they saw that, they knew that it could well be some sort of internal thoracic injury. That means that, okay, there could be a torn vein. As it turned out, there was a torn pulmonary vein. The blood pressure had dropped. The blood pressure was down to 70, which is still, it's not catastrophic, but it is low. So they knew by that stage that she had an injury which they could not tell from the ambulance. And that's the issue. The issue is, where can this patient be helped? And there's a certain thing known as the golden hour in medical circles, and that's an hour that you get where you just have to do something if it's a serious injury. And this was a serious injury, even though she scored so well in the Glasgow coma. She still had a life-threatening situation. So when you look at the transcripts for the base is asking the ambulance, well, when are you leaving? When is the ambulance going? You know, and it stayed in the tunnel. The ambulance stayed in the tunnel for 1 hour and 1 minute. So it didn't leave until sort of 1:41, so it was 1 hour and 18 minutes after the crash until the ambulance left the tunnel. So, but the base was concerned that the ambulance hadn't left, you know, and you can see that from the transcripts. And one of the other thing you can see from the transcripts is that De Rossi, who's the one phoning the base, says nothing for the thorax, and he says it twice to the base, that there's nothing for the thorax. Now, that's a direct lie, because he knew, because they'd done the examination, that there was a thoracic trauma. So he knew there was something to do with the thorax, and yet he said nothing for the thorax. And to the base, and what that establishes is that when the ambulance finally arrives at the hospital, that they won't have a cardiothoracic expert on hand to deal with Diana. So, And that's exactly what happened. By the time the ambulance got to the hospital, the cardiothoracic surgeon was at home in bed. Well, that, if they had told them, the base, okay, there's a thoracic trauma, then the base would have told the hospital, oh, you need a thoracic expert there, there's a trauma, you know? And so it was a sort of, there's a combination of things. The other thing is they were pouring in these, what's called catecholamines, which is something that increases the blood pressure. Now, the blood pressure was 70, it wasn't. And the inquest expert, the cardio expert at the inquest, said, well, with a blood pressure of 70, you wouldn't be, and a thoracic trauma, you wouldn't be putting in these catecholamines, because what they do is they increase the blood pressure, but they also will increase the pressure on any injury inside the body. So if there is a tear in a vein, then it's going to just increase the blood that's coming up, that's leaking from that. So these are very serious things, because they've started pouring these catecholamines, and then they did it over a very long period, because it took a hell of a long time to get to the hospital. So then the other aspect is that just before they got to the hospital, they stopped. The ambulance stopped. And there was two journalists who witnessed it. They witnessed a rocking ambulance, and they also witnessed a doctor get out of the front of the ambulance into the back. So they already had three people in the back. They had the doctor, and they had two interns, student interns, and then they the fourth person came out of the front into the back, so they ended up with four people in the back with Diana. And this is just near the hospital gates, 500 yards from the hospital gates. They never gave a credible explanation for why they stopped the ambulance, and that stopped for 5 minutes. And so the journalists saw a rocking ambulance, and so then you ask, well, what were they doing? You know, and inside the ambulance they said that they weren't doing a cardiac massage. They said that Martino said he stopped the ambulance so that he could increase her fluids, because he thought she might have a cardiac arrest. So she didn't have a cardiac arrest at that stage. But then when she did get to the hospital, she only survived for another 6 minutes. So she had already survived the 1 hour 43 minutes, and then she survived another 6 minutes, and then she stopped breathing.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
And she never got her breath back. So that was her life ended 6 minutes after arriving at the hospital. So then the focus must be on, okay, what was done in the ambulance? Why did she die straight after she arrived at the hospital?
So now the other people in the car. So now I noticed there was, you know, the bodyguard, Trevor Rees-Jones, and he survived. But now he's claiming he had no memory of anything.
And then
he also ended up having a separate relationship with his boss, which was Elfie-eyed, right?
Yes, that's right.
Did you ever get to talk to him or see anything dealing with him? And what did he ever change his statement?
Oh yeah, he's changed his statement. He's changed his statement a few times. His evidence is very sort of unreliable. I think that there's issues with the bodyguards, both him and Kez Winkle, who was a bodyguard as well at the hotel. They had what they call a decoy plan that they put in force so that Diana and Dodi travelled in a separate Mercedes, different to the one they'd been using through the day, and they left from the rear of the hotel, whereas the main Mercedes was out the front. So they used it as a decoy to put off the paparazzi. Trevor Rees-Jones and Kez Winkle, they both lied repeatedly on different issues. They have a they had to sort of protect their reputations as bodyguards, because see what happened at the hotel is that Henry Paul had a couple of Rickards, which was an alcoholic drink, in the hotel in the sort of couple of hours leading up to the crash. So he wasn't over the limit. He had enough in those two Rickards. I think I've forgotten what his BAC would have been, his blood alcohol concentration, but it was nowhere near the limit. In France, the limit's 0.5, not 0.5, but the thing is that it was alcohol. He did have a couple of drinks, so, and they were there when he had the drinks. He was sitting at the same table as them. So basically, the situation is that he shouldn't have been allowed to drive the car, because once they knew that he was drinking alcohol, then the bodyguard should have said, okay, well, you can't drive the car. Now, they never did that. The whole idea of Henry Ford driving a car is unusual anyway, because he had never actually driven guests at any time in his 11 years at the hotel. So this was the first time he ever drove any guests. When he went out to the airport that day as well, that was the first time he drove for the hotel. And then the trip into the tunnel when they had the crash, that was the first time he drove guests, because he had Dinah and Jody in the car on that trip. But it was on the trip from the airport. He only had the luggage and the other people who were not guests in the hotel. So they basically knew that Henry Paul was drinking alcohol, so they then had to say in their police statements that they thought he was drinking, they called it pineapple juice or pineapple cordial. They were lying because they knew that he was drinking alcohol. But the thing is, if they had admitted that they knew he was drinking alcohol, then they would have lost their careers, because they shouldn't have let anyone who had been drinking alcohol drive the couple. Now, I'm not saying that the alcohol that Henry Paul drank really affected his judgment to that extent, because, I mean, that's why they have the limit. So if you go over the limit, okay, there can be a chance that it's affecting your judgment. The implication is if you're under the limit, then basically you should be able to drive. So, but the thing is, because he was a chauffeur, then that's different, puts him in a different situation as far as the bodyguards are concerned, you know, so they shouldn't let him drive. Now, these guys have lied to protect themselves. Yeah, Trevor S. Jones is part of that. So I think I haven't actually studied into the amnesia aspect yet. That's one of the things I still have to do. There's still another volume that's still got to come out on this, but the indication is that he may well have not lost his memory, because there was evidence from one of the housekeepers at the Alfred Apartments in Parkland in London. And she said that she had spoken to Trevor East Jones, and he had told her not too long after the crash that if his memory came back, that he would be in trouble. So he may have been forced to be silent.
Right. And so now he worked for Dodi Fayed's dad, right, Al Fayed. And Henry Paul, the driver you were talking now, so he worked for the hotel then?
Yeah, well, Henry Paul worked for the hotel, but the hotel was owned by Al Fayed, so he was working for Al Fayed.
So they're all in it. So now his family seems to be happy that they're probing this a lot, because they don't think it was an accident either, do they, actually?
Yeah, well, that's right. No, they both think that there's more to it. Yeah, that's right. They have a different angle, the Henry Paul's family, because they say, well, there's no way he worked for intelligence. Well, I mean, the evidence that Henry Paul worked for intelligence is very strong. But they're in denial over that. Well, that's understandable. I mean, it's their kid, so they wouldn't necessarily want it acceptable. It's not acceptable to them that he was working for intelligence, basically. Whereas I think Al Fayed accepts that he was. even though he was an employee. But it's pretty standard, actually, that in these high-class hotels, that the security department, there'll be people in the security department that are working for intelligence, because intelligence has an interest in people who visit high-class hotels.
Right.
So, yeah, so that's pretty, that's not really a shock. But
no,
okay, Henry Paul had connections with intelligence. But now the level of involvement and the money that he was getting, there was big money he was receiving. He was receiving much more than his Fritz wage each year from intelligence, and that's in his bank accounts. He had 17 bank accounts, and he had contacts, he had intelligence contacts in his phone diary. So he was definitely working for intelligence.
And so now with all the cover-up, the French cover-up and the British and the corruption of Scotland Yard, so who do you think is behind everything? Like, who's the one that wanted her dead?
Well, the evidence indicates that there's two motives. Firstly, there was her involvement in the anti-landmines campaign. So she was revving that up. She had been to Angola in January 97, and then in February 97, she received a death threat over the phone from the person who was the Minister of the Armed Forces in the UK, Nicholas Soames. He phoned her in February 97 and said to her that she should lay off the landmines campaign. And that accidents, he said, an accident can happen, something along those lines. So basically she received a death threat from him, and then actually in August she went on another visit, this time to Bosnia, and that was in the same month she died. So, and that was all part of her anti-landmines campaign. She gave a major speech about landmines in June 1997. The fact is that Diana was a humanitarian, and she would have been moving on to other weapons. I don't think if she had won on landmines and got them completely banned, then she would have moved on to something else, you know, like cluster bombs or whatever. You know, so she was a real threat to the arms industry. And the other motive, particularly her involvement with Mohammed Al-Fayed. Mohammed Al-Fayed was actually a long-term family friend of her father and the family. And then in June 97, he offered for her to have a holiday at his villa in the south of France, and she accepted that. But it wasn't just her that was going to be going on this holiday. She was going to be taking Prince William and Prince Harry. Now, Prince William, of course, was a big king of England. So basically, this was a very bad, if you sort of, I don't know if bad's the right move, but it was a move that caused concern in the establishment, British establishment. And this is because Mohammed Al-Fayed was looked on as a man of ill repute. And he had actually only just in that early in the year, he'd been involved in a cash for questions scandal, which actually helped bring down Conservative government in the UK in May 1997. So he was looked on as being quite involved as a responsible party in the change of government. And the senior royals always had a hand in this. And what happened is there was a period of time from 1992 when Diana was causing trouble for the Queen and for the senior royal family. And back in 1992, what happened was she had been involved in a collaboration with Andrew Morton in a book called Diana, A True Story, I think. And anyway, it was published in about June 1992. And any royal reading it knew that she is involved, even though she wasn't, her name wasn't sort of in there as a collaborator. It was obvious that she was collaborating, and she had provided information that, about the inside workings of royal, her mistreatment by royals, that sort of thing. does in the book. So that really upset Queen Philip and others, and she received some very strong letters from Philip immediately following it. Within 10 days or something, she got the first letter. So then later that year, in November 92, the Queen set up an organisation called the Way Ahead Group, which is a committee that meets twice a year to deal with major issues facing the royal family. And there's very little doubt that Diana would have been on that agenda of that first meeting and how to deal with her. And it was straight after that the Queen insisted on the two, Charles and Diana, separating and officially being separate, and that was announced in Parliament in December 1992. So that was the first thing, and then in 1995 Diana went on national TV from the BBC, and what she'd said in the book, her version of the book, she now actually said on TV in a very much more full-on situation than just being a unnamed collaborator in a book. So this time she was on national TV in an interview saying the same sort of stuff, and that, you know, there were three in our marriage, and it was a crowd sort of thing, it was a bit crowded or something like that, and things like Charles should never become king. So once again that upset, that was sort of directly at the heart of the royals, and it upset the Queen, and so this time that was in November 95, and this time in December she sent a letter to Diana telling her that her and Charles should get a divorce, and that's exactly what happened. And in August 96 the divorce went through, except that the Queen took her a lot further than just a divorce, and she actually divorced her from the royal family, not just from Charles. So she withdrew her HRH title and Royal Highness title, and also effectively removed her from the royal family. So even though she was the mother of the future king, I think basically once the Queen had done that, and she was outside of, Diana was outside of the royal circle completely. I mean, she'd already been outside since the separation, but she was completely outside and a complete free agent. And so if she did anything more to upset the royals, then the only way they could deal with it would be something through something illegal. So when this business happened with Muhammad Al-Fayed taking William and Harry to Muhammad Al-Fayed's villa, I think that really, the evidence indicates that that actually generated a special meeting of the Way Ahead Group. So the Way Ahead Group was scheduled to meet in September that year, but they actually brought forward the meeting to July. The decision was made after Diana had done her major anti-landmine speech, and also after the acceptance of her holiday with William and Harry to Muhammad Al-Fayed's villa. So anyway, whilst at the villa, Dodi also came after a few days, son, and they struck up a very close friendship, and that developed very quickly into a relationship after the conclusion of the holiday. So that was another factor then. So you had a build up of actions by Diana. She was upsetting people in high places, and so I think it was a combination of the royals, that they had the special Way Ahead Group meeting, which was held on the 23rd of July 1997. That was 3 days after the conclusion of that holiday. So it may well be that around that time an order was given. So yeah, the thing with this sort of thing is it's always circumstantial, because you're never going to get anyone from that Way Ahead Group meeting putting their hand up and saying, yeah, well, she was discussed. There was actually a newspaper article on the 20th of July, 3 days before the meeting, saying that Diana was top of the agenda at that upcoming Way Ahead Group meeting. So there was a leak from the royal household to the paper indicating that Diana was on the agenda. So there's every reason to believe that she was. The meeting was a special meeting. It wasn't the normal Way Ahead Group meeting, and it's quite possible that either at that meeting or around that meeting, an order was given to MI6 by the senior royals to eliminate Diana, and that coincided with the anti-landmine operations that she was carrying out as well. So the Queen would have had on board the leaders of the UK, France, and the US, and who at that time, I think, those Jacques Chirac in France was Tony Blair and Ferdinand Bill Clinton in the US. And it's interesting, actually, see from the French viewpoint, why would the French... the French had to absolutely be on board anyway because the whole thing happened in France.
Right.
So why would they support the royal family? They wouldn't. But why would the French support the royal family, the British royal family? They wouldn't. So why are the French involved? Well, it's because of the landmines, because arms are a huge factor in French, for the French government. So that would be why they would get on board. And the same with Tony Blair and Bill Clinton. And it's interesting with Bill Clinton, actually, that he, at the time, he made an announcement while Diana was still alive, that the US would be signing an anti-landmines treaty, which was set for the 17th of September, which is 2.5 weeks after the crash. 17th of September, there was a meeting in Oslo, Norway, and he had said that the US would sign the treaty to ban landmines. And yet after Diana died, during that 2.5 weeks, Bill Clinton made another statement saying that they had reversed that decision and that the US then would not sign the treaty. So that's what happened. When the treaty got signed, the US did not sign it.
Hmm. And so now I noticed you've also done a book, The Documents the Jury Never Saw. So do you think it would have been different if they would have seen what you suggest?
Oh, absolutely. It absolutely would have been different. Yeah. There were things that were so important in those documents. They are probably the most, in some ways, the most important documents in the case. Imagine being on a jury, you're at an inquest, and you're on the jury, and you don't get shown the post-mortem report for the person that you're investigating the cause of death. See, the post-mortem is all about establishing cause of death. That's what a post-mortem is. And so for the jury not to be shown that report, why? Why were they not shown it? And when you look into it, the documents, not just the post-mortem report, but other surrounding documents from the toxicology of the samples from Diana, it reveals that the samples the toxicologists tested were not from Diana. So the toxicologists were told that they were Diana's samples, but they weren't from Diana, because Diana's body was embalmed in Paris before it was transferred over to the UK, and yet the samples on the postmortem had no embalming fluid in them. And there's actually notes from the toxicologist who did the testing, Susan Patterson was her name, and she's got notes there of her contacting authorities on the way postmortems are done and that sort of thing, and she's contacting these people to find out whether it's possible to have a body with a blood sample. A body that has been embalmed with a blood sample that has no embalming fluid on it, because she's shocked. She's tested the sample. There's no embalming fluid, and yet she knew Diana had been embalmed. So, these things. Plus, there was no alcohol in the tested samples either, whereas Diana had been drinking some alcohol at the hotel. So, these things just don't add up. So, if you were on the jury and you saw that, just that, without seeing hundreds of other documents, just so much information. But if you'd just seen that, you would think, you'd have second thoughts, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Why the hell haven't I been shown this post-mortem report, you know? Well, if they were shown it, then they would have questions, because they'd be thinking, well, hang on, this sample's stone out and bone, but how can that be?
Wow. And so now Diana thought, so you were saying earlier that she actually thought someone was going to kill her and it would be an accident. Who did she think was going to kill her?
Yeah, well, she, in her, there's two notes that relevant to this. She gave that note I spoke about earlier to her butler, and then she also, in the same month, she had a meeting with her lawyer. It was actually a meeting to do with the marriage, but at the end of the meeting, she told the lawyer, who was Lord Victor Mishcon, that she expected she could die in a car crash, orchestrated car crash. And so he actually went home, and next morning he wrote up a note of what she had said. So he thought it was that important. And then he got it typed up, and then he locked it up in a safe. So there were two notes. It sort of indicates that she was fearful. In the first note, it actually names her husband. Because at the time in October 95, he was her husband, and that was Charles she was referring to, Prince Charles. So she thought that he was orchestrating. And then in the note from Mishcon, it indicated more like the sort of, maybe the establishment of a senior royals. There was no actual name. She didn't name anyone in that one. But when she spoke to people, there were people that she spoke to saying she feared for her life. It was sort of MI6. She feared that she'd be done in by MI6, but basically on the instructions of, I think, senior royals or the establishment, that was her fear. She used to call the men in grey suits, and that was referring to sort of senior members of the royal household. But she definitely feared for her life. And one of the aspects of that was that after the death of Diana on 31st of August 97, Victor Mishcon went into the police. He called up Paul Condon, he didn't do it immediately. It was 2.5 weeks later. And what happened is, on the 17th of September 97, so 2.5 weeks after the crash, the French went public with that there'd been a second car involved, a white Fiat Uno, and the debris was in the tunnel and it crashed into the Mercedes. And there was paint from the Fiat Uno on the Mercedes. So they went public with that. They were searching for the driver of a white Fiat Uno. Now that was one of the first things that indicated something suspicious, you know. Oh, there was another car in this, you know. And the people didn't realise that until the police went public with that on the 17th of September. So apparently when Mishcon heard that, he thought, I've got a letter here, a note indicating that Diana feared she could be killed in a car crash, and now we've got a second car involved. And so that was too much for him, and he rang up the police commissioner, who Paul Condon, and said, I need to see you. And he was a leading lawyer, so that wasn't any problem. And he had a meeting either that day or the next day, and in that meeting he handed over the note. He had a copy of it he kept in the safe, but he handed over the note to Paul Condon. And what happened is, locked that note in the safe. So he did the opposite to what a police commissioner should have done with the note. I mean, you get a note from someone written in October 1995 in a meeting with her lawyer, that says, the lawyer wrote a note up afterwards that says that she's expecting to die in a car crash. And so the commissioner's given this note after she has died in a car crash. Now, if that had been Mrs. Brown down the road, who wrote a note predicting how she would die, and then she ends up dying in that way, then that would be enough to launch an investigation, you know, and so instead of, they didn't need to launch an investigation because an investigation was already set up in France. But instead of passing this note on to the investigation in France, Condon had it in a safe. And it stayed there for 6 years, and John Stevens took over as commissioner in 2000, and he kept it hidden. And then in 2003, that's the year that Paul Barrell, the butler, went public with his note, so the second note. And so once he had done that, the police were in a very, very difficult situation because they were hanging on to a note, a second note, that said very similar to what was in Paul Barrell's note. Now, that wouldn't be a problem because no one really knew about the police note except they did. And the police knew they knew, and the people who knew were Victor Mishcon, who was still alive at that stage, and also there were two other lawyers present at that meeting with Diana, and they also knew about the note. And Maggie Ray and Sandra Davis, they were lawyers who worked at Mishcon's company, so but it wasn't just them, other people at Mishcon were also aware that that Mishcon had gone to the police 2.5 weeks after the crash with a note. So once Barrell went public, the lawyers at Mishcon would have been reading the paper and thinking, ah, that's interesting, you know, and then Mishcon actually got in touch with R. Stevens, the Commissioner of Police, at that time in 2003. So then the police were forced into releasing the note to the coroner, to the British coroner. The French investigation had closed by that stage. And so the British coroner was shown that note. It took them another couple of months. They got legal advice, the police sought legal advice, because they had to work out what their legal situation was, because they had suppressed evidence. See, the police was meant to be about investigating evidence, not suppressing it. And so the very fact that they did suppress the note indicates a cover-up, you know, again.
Yeah, they were trying to protect somebody, yeah.
Sure.
So where do you see this going now?
I think that, really, there should be some justice. I mean, there's been no justice so far. I think there's two aspects to it. I suppose one part of justice is that people get to know what occurred. I think, you know, there are a lot of people who believe Diana was murdered. They just don't know exactly how it occurred or what took place. But it's a question of, I'm doing my best to try and publicise that as much as I can. So it's a question of people becoming aware of what occurred. But the other aspect of justice is, okay, why can't something judicial occur, you know, that corrects the wrongs? Because, I mean, the inquest was so corruptly run by a corrupt judge, Scott Baker, and then the police investigations were completely corrupt as well in both France and the Britain. And so maybe the International Court of Justice could carry out some sort of just inquest. I mean, that's the only possibility I can really think of. I don't think you could possibly get justice in France or Britain. So it has to be something international. And maybe it could happen in the future. I'm not sure whether that's ever going to happen, but it's possible. I think once the Queen dies, that there'll be much more pressure from William and Harry to not just have something proper done. Yeah, when after the Queen dies, you know, and William and Harry, I'd say that we put much more pressure will come to bear, I think, because, you know, if I was in William's situation, I put myself in this situation, you know, and your mother's died in a suspicious car crash, but it's never really been dealt with. It's never been dealt with, you know. And so she's a public figure, so you would want the public to know, I think, about how it occurred. He may well have his own suspicions, you know, and Mary might, well, they can't say at this stage, but in the future, that things will change once the Queen's gone. And I think there'll be a lot of pressure on Charles to to actually... The indication is that Charles wasn't directly involved. It more came from the Queen, possibly Philip, but it was very... there's no actual evidence that places Charles in the gun, really. It's higher up.
Now, how do people get a hold of you and how and get a hold of your books? Like, what's the best way?
Yeah, well, I've got a website, which is www.princessdianadeaththeevidence.weebly.com. And that website has got my contact email address, and it's also got all the information about the books. It's got a lot of other stuff as well, a lot of videos and interviews and stuff that I've done over the years. And also there's a lot of information about the reactions by leading people in the UK and towards the books and things like that. So, yeah, there's a lot of stuff on the website.
Okay, and we'll actually post all that so people can get to it on the website and the Facebook, so people can get in contact with you.
Yeah, great.
Yeah, and we appreciate it.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Summer's just around the corner, so give your body the care it deserves with Osea's best-selling Undaria Algae Body Oil. Created by infusing Undaria seaweed in barrels of botanical oils, it leaves skin silky soft and glowing. Plus, it's clinically proven to improve elasticity and deeply moisturize without feeling greasy. It's safe, clean, vegan skincare. Get 10% off your first order at OseaMalibu.com with code GLOW, plus free shipping on orders over $60.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.